All right. Today on Measured Impact, we are joined by Alan and James, co-founders of Brewgooder, a purpose-led beer brand using business as a force for good. Since launching Brewgooder, Alan and James have built a certified B Corp that channels beer sales into clean water, food security, and community projects around the world, challenging what responsible growth looks like in a highly competitive consumer space. Their work sits at the intersection of brand, impact, and measurement, and asking how choices can fund real outcomes and how businesses can scale and still hold their values close. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I'm psyched today because I love all things values almost as much as I like beer. So I'm excited to talk to you guys. We love the name. I love all the branding. It's been we're psyched to get you on board. We had a couple people recommend you guys as a good fit for this, and I think your ethos is perfectly in line. So before we get too far down the rabbit hole, tell me who you are and a little bit of your background. James, you want to go first?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm James. I'm, I guess, considered now sort of co-founder of Brewgooder. So met Alan very serendipitously, let's say, back in 2016. He'd come up with the concept for Brewgooder already. It was kind of already in, the wheels were in motion. And I took to the idea. I took to Alan as a person as well. We were sort of aligned socially as well as, I guess, morally. And you know, the ambition of what Alan's looking to achieve with Brewgooder was just one that caught my attention. So no prior beer industry experience whatsoever. I'd done a few kind of startups or, you know, roles in various startups prior to that, but nothing concrete other than just a belief that I thought one day we could get somewhere quite cool with it, and off we set.
And Alan, I know your story goes back a little bit further, so give us all the Nepal of it all.
Yeah, so I think maybe like the journey to here in 2026 is probably started maybe about 2012. So when I was younger, I was leaving university with not really like what they would call a CV. I don't know what you guys call it in the States, maybe it's a resume, but I kind of was leaving thinking I've got this good degree from the University of Glasgow, but I don't really have an idea of what I want to do with my career. So I did a few things. I volunteered playing football in Glasgow, helping integrate like refugee communities with the local community in a quite deprived neighborhood in South Hill in Glasgow. But that was kind of like just like playing football on the weekend, right? That's not really pushing yourself too hard. What I did decide to do was sign up to a sort of volunteering trip in Nepal. And I think the funny part of it all is when you're 22 and money's pretty tight and you're going away to some foreign country, you have to go through like all these injections and sort of like inoculations to stop you from getting some brain rotting disease that you might catch in a cave somewhere if you're ever unlucky enough to do that. But they cost a lot of money, right? Like they cost like 80 quid, 90 quid or whatever, $200. And at that time, like you sort of pay attention to that. And then the one thing that they give you for free in the GP or the doctors is just don't drink the water. Like don't, if you can't crack the lid off it, if you can't boil it, if you can't put a tablet in it to clean it up, like just don't touch it. And I think maybe because they give the idea for free, I didn't really pay too much attention to it, or because I was 22, I thought that I was better than any medical advice.
Your stomach was just stronger than the average person's.
Exactly, right? I had a lot of pints of Tennent's in university, and I thought that that would steel me against anything. And yeah, I went there. I had more than one occasion where I drank water that I couldn't see its source or even could look at it and think maybe this isn't the best thing in the world. And I got sick. I got, you know, 3 weeks in, things stopped working like they probably should, and then 3 months later, you know, it's starting to have a pretty visible and pretty nasty effect. But I came back home, I got a very, very common prescription for an antibiotic called metronidazole, and before you know it, I was like back doing whatever it is that I wanted to do, and just kind of plan a better life for myself. And that kind of wasn't, I wouldn't call it a vocational calling, but there was definitely something inside me that said, like, you've only ever had this, like, positive, hopeful future, whereas there was people born on the exact same day as you that that haven't even passed, you know, your collective fifth birthday, right? When you were on a bouncy castle having a party with your school kid friends, they might not have actually even been here. And that for me was like the first sort of wake up moment where I was like, right, okay, maybe I need to use my skills, like how I was brought up, to impact the world in a positive way, right? Give people opportunities and hope and positive outcomes. So I applied for lots of jobs in the international development sector with charities. I got rejected from every single one of them. When I did start working, it was in the homelessness space in Scotland, and that's a whole different story and podcast, I'm sure. But I did two things when I went from poor student to poor graduate. I traded up my coffee and I traded up my beer, and I just fell in love with the craft beer space. And I thought, wouldn't it be good if you could combine that vocational calling, if you like, to do some good in the world with an industry that is quite cool and you're, you know, you could be passionate about. So when I came up with the name Brewgooder, it's obviously such a good pun that you should dedicate the rest of your working life to making it work.
they say to just plan your career solely around a half baked pun that you had after a few times.
I could not let that one slip. So I pitched the idea, like, we would have this brand, and originally it was like, you know, 100% of profits to clean water, right? And it doesn't take a genius to work out that a 25-year-old sort of, like, you know, naive guy would come up with such a ridiculous business model, right? That's changed, and we can get into that and how it's been more impactful, arguably, you know, by not having that. But I pitched this idea to lots of people, right? We're going to sell beer, we're going to give people water. And a lot of people were like, yeah, good on you, man, that sounds good. But, like, they were looking through you kind of, that's never going to work. And the first person that really, I think, got it on a really deep level was James. I pitched it to him on his sofa when he didn't know me, after a night out on a hangover. And he was gracious enough to not just not kick me out of his kitchen, but to make me a coffee and to hear about what Brewgooder was as a plan. But I think Brewgooder wouldn't exist, certainly wouldn't have went on the journey, wouldn't have, I think, evolved into, it's sort of like, you know, the brand that is now and the impact that we have had, if it wasn't for James's sort of almost like more 4D version of what Brewgooder could be, as opposed to my sort of, I need to get this idea out into the world and see if it works. So yeah, we've been partnered now for, you know, the guts of 10 years, and while sometimes it feels like a lifetime, I'm sure James will agree with that, I think on our day we're still fresh and up for the innovation, up for the fight in, like you said, what's a really challenging and competitive space.
It's such a cool story. I think the thing that really jumped out to me is that, you know, it sounds like the idea has stayed true, right? Wanting to do good, no pun intended, or pun very much intended, I don't know. But how you guys were going to execute that seems like it's changed a lot over the last 10 years. So can you talk a little bit about, either of you, about sort of going in bright-eyed, well-intended, virtuous, whatever, 25-year-old to where you guys are today, and how has that evolved, and what made you take that journey to sort of rethinking the model and potentially how that changed the impact and the scale you can have?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think going back to how, you know, when Alan and I met, there was a real raw authenticity to Alan's sort of initial ideation on what Brewgooder was for him at that time. You know, he'd come out of that experience in Nepal with this idea to combine, you know, a personal love of beer with a personal affinity for, at that time, you know, clean water and sanitation projects off the back of what he'd experienced. But I think very early on, even before working and just conversing with Alan, it was clear to me that it was less about a personal affinity to specific social issues such as clean water and sanitation, and much more a values-driven pursuit. You know, his idea of, you know, the world being fundamentally unfair. You know, you're born into a circumstance, it's effectively a coin flip as to where you end up and what your prospects are. Yeah. And the sort of key barriers that exist, both on a global level but also on a local one too, that prevent certain segments of society going on to achieve what they want and to prosper. So I think very early on, as early as that, I saw this path to evolve Brewgooder from not necessarily one you know, fixated on one specific issue, but rather a brand that could exist to harness the power of beer, you know, the shared values that exist among people out there towards key areas in the world, both on a global and a local basis. And that's kind of where we're at today. Okay. Of course. No worries. Let me double check.
Yeah, we like to ask the heartfelt questions and then be like, no, good, just try it again. Do it one more time exactly like that. Try to pretend you didn't just say it.
Would it be within this Riverside UX that I could look at this or elsewhere?
Yeah, so if you go to your settings up in the top right.
Yeah.
And then go to all settings. And then in audio and video, you should see your camera, your mic, and your headset there.
Yeah, so it's given me my camera, inbuilt microphone, which is all good, external. Output, I think, is just the speaker right now of the computer. Do I mute that? Would that help? Oh, no, it's not coming through my headphones then. Just here? Yeah.
So his sound is good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Inputs here. This mic. And then I've just got normal headphones hooked in.
But you're hearing yourself through the headphones. Are you hearing me through your headphones?
Yeah.
No, it shouldn't be if you hear something through the...
Okay, cool. Alan, you've just muted. Do we need to mute when each of us is? Would that help?
No, I don't think so. I think you're fine. Yeah.
Cool. No worries.
All right, so, you know, obviously the question is, as you guys became a little bit more, sounds like you've sort of shifted the focus and the approach to having that impact, right? The impact was there, but the intent for the impact was there, but perhaps the business model changed or how you were going to think about what values looked like to you guys changed a little bit. So, James, can you talk a little bit about how and why you guys – sort of went on that journey to change the approach from just being a pure sort of 100% profits go to charity to thinking differently about how you guys wanted to approach it from a business or a structural model?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there was a lot of authenticity and you know, rawness in Alan's original idea for Brugger that kind of stemmed from that personal experience in Nepal. You know, funding, opting to combine a passion for beer with kind of a very personal affinity at that time to clean water and sanitation projects was just, you know, a very simplistic and obvious route. But I think very, very early on, we realized that Brugger had the opportunity to stand for so much more than that. You know, whilst beginning with that kind of clean water message and objective, it became very clear that this was almost a values-led proposition. You know, so rather than any specific limited affinity to one particular social issue, it was a desire to realize and live out values such as equity, dignity, structural justice, and community through the power of a company and a platform and a brand. So that's really how it's evolved over time, is rather than just being confined to one particular space, we deliver impact both on a global and on a local level through our foundation and through a number of different business practices as well, beyond just, I guess, grant giving and donation of proceeds.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you have to put yourselves in our shoes, right? Like, we were 25. Like, we didn't have a clue. This is our first business. Like, this was a business that was built on, if you like, probably, like, an anxiety, like, were we doing enough to justify why we had a space in the industry, right? So the 100% of profits model, certainly in the first few years, was our way of saying, like, we're in this, if you like we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. And I think that was the important bit for me, was like, how do we get out ahead of, like, anybody who says, oh, you're not making enough impact, you're not doing things the right way. And for me, that was like that 100% profits model. But it was such a naive one, right? Because year one, year two, year three, that can work to an extent, right? But it's going to be diminishing returns. You can't invest in the brand. You kind of get stuck. And it wasn't really until COVID happened that we had this, I guess, like, epiphany moment where we didn't think we were going to make any more profit, right? We didn't actually know if we were going to do, like, even the water thing again, because it was such an existential threat to our business. That actually probably was the best thing that could have happened in the long run for us, right? Because we were actually moving in the direction of being almost like a charity within the craft beer space within the UK. One of our last sort of version one Brugger, if you like, the prototype Brugger campaigns, was a thing called the Global Gathering, where 250 breweries from around the world, from Vancouver to Hong Kong to Sydney, had all signed up to raise money for clean water projects. And that was meant to launch on the 20th of March, 2020. And, like, the worst thing you could do is gather, let alone have a global gathering, right? Like, and it was almost like an act of God sort of stepped in and said, no, that's not going to happen anymore. And I was in Edinburgh and James was in Glasgow at the time. And I remember our Prime Minister came on the news and basically said, listen, if you're in a pub, that's it. Like, go home, like, go, you know, lock yourselves indoors and we'll worry you about this, you know, how we get through this over the next few days. And James sort of phoned me up and said, listen, if we're going to go down, let's go down swinging. Like, we've built this brand, we've got all this beer, we don't know where to sell it. What would happen if we allowed effectively the NHS, like the sort of like frontline healthcare workers, to access that beer that somebody else paid for, you know, $10 equivalent or whatever, could write a note that we would fulfill and stick on the pack and send it to them. And it just blew my mind that I was like, actually, that doesn't feel alien to us, right? Like, the act of doing good things and nice things and almost, I wouldn't necessarily call it activist things, but reacting to allow people to show, you know, compassion or solidarity didn't feel alien. And it actually allowed us to move in different directions. And then from 2020, we actually decided that every pint would have a guaranteed contribution built into it. So that guaranteed contribution would allow us to make, you know, as long as we had the finance and the runway and the funding, would allow us to make contributions as we actually scaled the business. And we went from, you know, a little under maybe $1.5 million turnover in 2020 to nearly $8 million by 2024, right? So we actually went on this steep journey. And then the proliferation happened in terms of, right, actually, why don't we do other things that allow us to show the good within Brugger? And the next stage along was, there was a huge cost of living crisis in 2022, 2023 in the UK. And we actually said, right, well, could we fund access to healthy food for people who are, you know, on that sort of poverty line? And we were funding local pantries. And again, that was an initiative, I think, that was spurred on by James sort of seeing that, not necessarily opportunity, because I wouldn't call it opportunity, but it would be like something like, we need, you know, there's an inbuilt thing with us, I think, is like, we feel the need or the urgency to act in a way that we would want to see people act into the world, if that makes sense. So as our, you know, I would love to say that there's some amazing strategy and there's a AI brain working on, like, what does Brugger do next from an impact perspective? But a lot of the times it's literally just like, what do we care about as human beings? What do we care about? What do we think we can do validly, if you like, in this space, and that's definitely evolved over time. So like, let's not underestimate the fact that we have been winging it for 10 years, but we've been winging it in a way where we haven't made too many fatal mistakes, and actually we've probably matured as people and as an organization, and that's allowed us to step into spaces that I could not have imagined stepping into in 2016 when we started this, but actually feel like natural territory now 10 years later in 2026.
Yeah, well, it seems like you guys kind of have held true to the idea of the mission and idea of being values-led, but how that looks changes over time and how that manifests itself and what's the pressing issue. So it's really cool to see that you guys have, whether intentionally or accidentally, sort of created a system that allows you to, you know, pivot to the issue that feels core to you at that point in time. And that I think is pretty unique when you think about, like, you know, if you had actually fully gone down on, we are going to just fully do clean water, that's all we're going to talk about, you can pigeonhole yourself into a scenario where you're competing against 100 other charities, quote unquote, that are doing the same thing, and your message can sound pretty similar. So I really dig the idea of being able to be a little bit more reactive while holding true to sort of who you guys are. It's pretty neat. I'm curious, as you guys are thinking about sort of planning and sort of mapping out where the brand goes, you know, a year from now or whatever it is, how do you integrate the mission and the value side into that, right? Is it as pragmatic as, if we sell more stuff, we have more capacity to have an impact? Or is it, thought of in a different way as you guys think about scale and what growth will look like? How do you think about the scale and the growth of your mission, your values, your impact alongside it?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Alan's kind of shared, you know, a few years in, we realized that the commercial / impact making model needed to change, and ultimately one that would allow both, you know, channels to scale. You know, the more beer we sell, the more impact we make, and that contribution per hectolitre of beer, or effectively per pint, definitely enabled that. And I think it also enabled our focus to actually then become much more based on how do we make this brand, you know, this beer company, work and sustainable for, you know, first and foremost as a beer company. Whilst obviously we would love every single person that picks up a pint or a can of Brugger to be aligned and motivated to make the impact that we want to make, we also want to make a brand that more drinkers than not enjoy and want to be, you know, are proud seen holding at the pub or among their friends. So I think certainly in the last 2 or 3 years has been this focus, at least internally, and there's still, I think, a lot to come publicly in terms of just making this brand first and foremost one designed for our target consumer in mind. You know, what do they want to be seen drinking? What do they enjoy? What type of activations do they like? You know, impact is definitely one critical element of this brand, but it can't be the only one because it gets very boring very quickly. It needs to be much more multifaceted than that. And I think, you know, we've got the fortune of learning from the best to do it. You know, there are impact brands or impact companies, I guess, as you would define them, that go back as far as the 80s, the likes of Ben & Jerry's. You know, they've had the best part of 40 years to get this right. You know, we're only, as much as 10 years is a long time to be around, it's still quite young, particularly for this type of proposition. And I think we're slowly but surely finding our feet in the right sort of Rubik's Cube combination that absolutely delivers on that impact front, but also makes the beer brand one that can thrive on in its own right.
Did you guys ever consider just calling it James and Alan?
Yeah, I mean, I've toyed with Aldo and Jim's, right? Like, I've definitely done that. But Brugger felt like it was such a, like you say, like to the start of it, such a good pun. But I think maybe if we were to reinvent it again, maybe that would be a name that's thrown into the hat.
Well, you know, I think as you guys are, you know, it's not accidental that you guys are here today. Our episode last week was Ben & Jerry's. I got multiple people who said, hey, these guys are kind of trying to do that same model in a totally different way and a new way. And I think it's no accident that you guys are having some success there, which is really cool. I'm interested in how you guys think about success. And Alan, I'll ask you first. It seems to me that it's a challenge sometimes. I know for myself, right? If I was to ask 2016 Alan what success looks like, that's going to be different than what it would be today. And maybe it's even hard to imagine this getting to the place that you guys are now. But how far out do you look when you're trying to gauge success? And what do you think, you know, you're hopeful that you'll look back and say, yeah, we set a goal to do this in the next X amount of time. And that's what's whether we did or we didn't achieve it. How do you think about what those goals really look like for you guys?
Well, we very much started from that place of like it was an impact target. And I think that actually kind of funneled everything in a quite a narrow and actually quite like diminishing returns way. I think we were like, I remember a 25-year-old me, I think on a video at least, if someone wants to look it up, said we want to bring 1 million people clean drinking water in 5 years. That's just not it is probably possible, right? But it wasn't possible in the circumstances and the resources that we find ourselves with, right? So success for me was very much an impact-orientated thing, right? But then what would happen, you know, at 999,999, right? Are you not successful? Like, you know, are you what happens with the person at 1,000,001, right? Like, it's probably not useful to look at it that way. As we've kind of developed, I think just having a space within our industry has actually been a bit of a success. Like, I mean, you know, the beer industry is probably one that's probably invests more marketing per, you know, square inch than lots, because it's an undifferentiated product in many ways, right? Like, it's hops and water and, you know, barley and that sort of thing. And you'll have this lager that claims to be from this place or that place, and there's these competing stories. But actually carving out a space for ourselves, like, we're, you know, very, very small in the grand scheme of things in the UK, but we're still a top 10, you know, craft beer brand in the UK, which is pretty powerful. James and I always say that if we had started anywhere but the UK, we probably would have had a better shot at this, right? Like, it's actually not that progressive a marketplace from a consumer point of view, or at least the pockets of progressive consumers are much smaller. If we had started this in, you know, the Netherlands, which is a much smaller country, or Australia, you know, there's actually a greater, you know, per capita concentration. So we would have probably had an outsized success relative to our size. And the beer market is heavily taxed, heavily competitive, you know, within the UK. So staying alive is successful. But as I kind of get a wee bit older, hopefully a little bit wiser and more mature, I still consider Brugger an experiment to prove whether or not you can disrupt this industry, this consumer vertical, whatever way you want to call it, of beer in the same way it's been disrupted in ice cream or chocolate with Tony's Chocolate Only, or, you know, Patagonia and clothing. You know, is it possible, right? Is the consumer preference, is the consumer behavior actually one that allows itself to lean into what James had said? Like, do people actually want to choose this because it's, you know, positive impact, or do people just want to choose it because it's cool, right? And we over-index in the positive impact piece for sure. We need to make it cool. So if I look at it now, I think, right, actually just surviving as a beer brand would be success. And then the sort of older me, if I'm looking back on my deathbed for my career, would be like, how many other people, even if you failed at doing that, would be inspired by the story and try and do something in their own industry or different? And could Brugger be an inspiration piece the way that, you know, the likes of Ben & Jerry's, Tony's, Patagonia are inspiration pieces for us, right? Like, we look at that and say, I don't think we've ever consciously said we want to be the Ben & Jerry's of the beer industry, right? We've never said that. We didn't write that down in the business plan in 2015, 2016. But when we look at it, we say, okay, right, these guys are doing this. We're sort of doing something that's quite similar. Like, we know that they survived. How did they do it? How did they make the right decisions? And we'll try and do that. But if someone then looks at us, and even if it's in the beer industry or if it's in a different vertical, and say, actually, what those guys were doing, it was so half-baked, but they managed to do something pretty positive, like, that inspires me to do something else. So there's lots of different measures for success. But we fully believe that, you know, with the right resource, with the right backing, with the right opportunities, with the right luck and fortune, there's no reason why this can't be an international brand, right? There's no reason that this should be confined to the UK. Like, I think there's probably far more drinkers and far more of a progressive consumer culture outside of the UK than in it. And I think that's kind of the bit that we're trying to understand. You know, first and foremost, we have to thrive in our own market, and that would be success on anyone's, you know, terms, given how competitive it is. But actually, would the brand promise of Brugger be let down in any way if it wasn't actually something that you could buy in the States, right? Or someone could roll into a, you know, a pub in Melbourne and actually, you know, grab a pint of this. So I think it evolves, it changes, and some days survival is everything, and then another day world domination is everything, right? Like you almost flip between the two. So yeah, success is hard to come by and always evolving. That's probably my understanding of the past decade.
Yeah, you know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking of, you know, in Yvon Chouinard's story, the thing that I thought was really interesting was not, you know, I've heard the Patagonia origin stories 100 times, but the, you know, the light bulb moment for me was when they were talking about basically getting Walmart to start selling organic cotton had more of an impact than everything else they did, right? Like just getting, encouraging other, showing other people what the organic cotton was even a thing, and what an understanding that their impact via influence was much more powerful than their impact via the number of fleeces they did or didn't sell, or the, you know, number of things they recycled. So it sounds like you guys kind of have figured that out early, which is pretty cool.
To an extent, right? I mean, we had a program where we started using, because of an introduction to the grain from the guys at Brooklyn Brewery, we started using a West African grain called Foneo in one of our beers. It was super successful on launch, and we were buying this stuff from, you know, West African smallholder farmers, right? Like, this was a hard product to work with. It was a hard product to source. But I thought if we were going to make this successful, we actually should make it like a fair trade certified, like, supply chain. And I sort of phoned up the guy that we were, you know, working with to source it, and he said, I can't get you any fair trade supply chain for you because one doesn't exist, right? So we spent 12 months certifying a, you know, supply chain from Guinea all the way to the EU and then on to the UK as fair trade, right? We were voluntarily, I guess, paying more money, right, to put a pittance in the small grand scheme, or in the grand scheme of things. But then when we got that certification, like, part of you is like, oh, that's a really cool USP for your beer. And then the other part is like, that's the most pointless way of looking at it. Like, we could not turn the dial on that supply chain, even if we sold 10 times the amount of beer next year. What would be even better is if you actually opened that supply chain to be used by anybody in the brewing industry, yeah, should they want to. And then that's the type of thinking, I think, that sort of puts yourself in a position where you're quite well aware that you might have a little butterfly effect, you know, like a little ripple out there, but you're not going to be the whole pond, right? And you need to open it up so that the whole pond can access the good thing that you've, you know, built. And that's our version on a very small scale of the Patagonia Walmart, you know, anecdote.
Yeah, it's really cool. It seems like you guys, you know, from the beginning have had an emphasis on sort of making impact more accessible beyond just you guys and selling the beer that you sell. So it's a really refreshing, again, pun heavily intended, way to approach it from the beginning. And I think, you know, you guys seem to have gotten there a little earlier than a lot of these other guys did when we think about the big players in the activism space. I'm going to switch a little bit in terms of when you guys, you know, a lot of our show is talking about how to think about how you can use what you measure to impact your decision making and kind of change how you might approach things. So I'm interested, and maybe James, this is something that you've seen. Has there been a data point or a learning or a metric that, like, you guys just ingested and then realized, oh shit, we got to, like, do things differently. We got to change our directions. We got to pivot a little bit. We got to start thinking about things differently. I'm curious if there's a piece of data, a number of learning, something that you guys have found along the way that has, you can point to and sort of say, yeah, and that really changed how we operate or how we market or how we, you know, prioritize our efforts.
I think it potentially goes back to that point around, you know, in order for a, any brand, I guess, but particularly this one, to be successful, that you can't necessarily hinge everything on that sort of impact angle solely. You know, I think when we first emerged, it was very clear that was, you know, we were almost quite one-dimensional. But I think because we were so different, you know, the industry really hadn't, certainly the beer industry hadn't really had a proposition like this as far as a day one, you know, impact platform and company, that external advice and people that probably hadn't done it before would just tell you to do more of that. You know, well, that's your USP, so just dial that up, you know, to the nth degree, to the extent that you're almost getting recommended in terms of our packaging designs. You know, we need the impact message front and center as big as possible. But I think with that comes a risk. You know, I think as much as we hear all the data points around young consumers, and particularly those of younger generations, being you know, more invested in kind of impact led companies and brands that, you know, want to do more positive things than just sell stuff, they also don't want to compromise. And I think there's this potential unspoken bias around, like, as soon as something is being seen to be doing good in some way, that you're compromising either through how much you pay for it or the quality of that product. So there is this tightrope that you almost need to walk to ensure that, yes, we want to get our message out there around Brugger is fundamentally different. We are trying to do something different within the space beyond just make the best possible beer of all time. But that doesn't mean our beer isn't good, you know, and you can just enjoy it like any other brand on the shelf. And I think understanding that and how we bake that into our strategy moving forward is going to be integral to whether or not this beer brand grows from current, you know, $5-6 million a year up to, as Alan mentioned, the global brand that we do think instinctively it can be. But it can't be just operating purely on, I guess, what it has been till now in terms of personal intuition. You know, things need formalized, the strategy needs built, that encompasses all of these things beyond just our personal pursuit to see Brugger achieve what we wanted it to from day one from an impact perspective.
Yeah, I'll probably add on to that with, like, we see decks all the time, either ones that we build or ones that we see, and it's like 90% of Gen Z consumers want, you know, impact companies and impact products. And you're like, well, then why are 90% of all Gen Z, or, well, let's call it millennials to give them their 18 plus, but, like, why aren't 80% of millennials then buying Brugger, right? It all depends on, like, there's a question there around stated preference versus revealed preference, right? Like, we're, of course, people will say that they want to buy from, you know, the best possible source and, you know, the most healthy, the most sustainable, the most environmentally friendly, the most, you know, ethical. Of course, people will say that. But the revealed preference is they will buy certain things that speak to them on a genuinely different level. A lot of that can be price, right? Like, you can't say this is the best thing in the world and for the world, but it's twice the price of the market leader, right? Or else you need to have serious campaigns and spend behind you to justify that from a marketing perspective. So what we've kind of learned is, like, what if there's this market out there, like, what else are we leaving on the table by only focusing on impact and the ethics of it? Like, are they drinking stuff? Are we making the beer that they drink, right? There's a huge push in, you know, fruited lager, for example, or moderation beers in this low ABV percentage. Until late last year, really, we weren't making those products, right? So we weren't even swimming where fishing where the fish were, right? We were hoping that by having we were almost expecting that to have something that spoke to the values of the younger consumer, that would be almost enough, when actually we needed to speak the entire language. And that's visual, you know, that's in terms of how we activate, what we look like. Of course, that's in terms of flavor profiles of beer and just the direction of the brand. Like, it's a very interesting time at the minute in the UK because we're entering that post-craft era, right? One of the biggest players in our industry sort of has had a sort of spectacular sort of fall from grace. And actually, that kind of marks for me this post-craft era. So there's lots of young consumers who are up for grabs now, who are moving out of that craft space, but they're not just going to move to a beer brand because it speaks to them on a values basis. They want good value. They want the right, you know, flavor profile. They want packaging. They want something that their, you know, older brothers or their dad doesn't drink, right? Like, there's so many psychological elements to it, that no matter how many people we brought clean water, or no matter how much money we spend, you know, we could write a check tomorrow for $1 million to cause A, B, C, right? And it does not connect with them. It doesn't. That's just nice, good on you guys, but like, that's not a compelling enough reason to drink it. I would say the only time we've come close that an impact campaign has actually fired up our consumer base in a really powerful way was a project called Southern Stone that we did with the Palestinian Brewery. I'm not sure if you want to talk about that.
Sure, yeah, let's hear.
Contentious. But
oh, yeah, we love contentious, all the things. Yeah. Let's get into it.
Maybe, James, you can talk about that project and what we saw with it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just before that, to sort of bookend that point, like, I think beer in particular as well is a really interesting product category versus others that we kind of reference in terms of having that category-defining impact offering. You know, beer is inherently such a social product, right? Unlike maybe a tub of ice cream or a bar of chocolate, you know, more often than not, you're consuming that among friends, among, you know, peers, maybe a first date. You know, there's signals that whatever you buy at the bar, there's signals that what you buy at the bar send to other people that you're surrounded by, you know, and more often than not, actually, there is evidence out there to show that people more often than not will buy something that sends the right signals versus actually what they want to drink. So I think that really just speaks to that point around building a brand that, you know, reflects and people feel, you know, comfortable that brand is reflecting them as a person in those types of social settings, which I think is another balancing act to pull off. But yeah, as Alan said, I think, you know, towards the tail end of last year, we've done various campaigns, you know, whether it's reactive or I guess what would potentially fall into that activism bucket, but probably nothing has ignited our community and I guess publicly seen the brand, you know, pushed into a space quite like Sun and Stone, which was a collaboration we pulled off with a West Bank based brewery, Tiber. And that all came about really from an article that we'd seen in probably about a couple of years ago now, covering their situation as a consequence of the conflict kind of escalating. Their story is incredible. For anyone listening, like, I would just recommend to read into Tiber Brewery. Been operating since 1994, without doubt running a brewery in the hardest place to run a brewery in the world. Now female-led, female brewmaster Madice Khoury, who's a daughter of one of the founders. And they've faced every obstacle you could ever think of, but in the last couple of years, obviously restrictions being imposed on them, you know, really limiting their movement, the movement of their beer, meant that their business was quite literally on the brink. And we quite quickly recognized the opportunity to support them really via one of the primary activities that you see within the beer space, which is collaboration. So breweries getting together, whether they're like-minded over the styles they produce through to obviously the values that they have. And one of the decisions that comes up during that sort of collaboration process is like, where are we actually going to physically brew this beer? Is it going to be your brewery or ours? And it occurred to us that all of the restrictions that were being imposed on Tiber were very physical. It was almost, you know, gates being put around the village, the ports being locked down, restricting the exporting of their product. But actually, all of that could be bypassed if we brewed the beer here in the UK, whilst obviously still being able to bring Tiber's brand, their story, and any message they wanted to land to customers here in the UK. So we decided to do that. We brewed a beer effectively at cost. So Brewgooder didn't take any margin from the initiative. And we landed on this name, Sun and Stone Lager, which was inspired by the region there in terms of the hills and obviously the warm climate. And the idea was that this would generate Tiber Brewery themselves, obviously some vital proceeds during, you know, quite a desperate time, in addition to supporting charities that were basically enabling on the ground work in Palestine. So yeah, that's kind of a brief run
through. That's so cool, man. I'm jealous of the, you know, sounds like the speed of which you guys were able to execute on an issue like that was pretty rapid, and I think that your ability to be nimble is pretty clear as you guys are reacting to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think it came from a moment where James and I sort of, you know, you get a lot of people who say, don't touch this issue. Like, don't touch it, don't do it, don't go anywhere near it, there's too many risks. And I think at a certain level as human beings, like, you know, James and I looked at each other and said, if we don't do this, like, we're bullshitters. Like, we're totally, like, we're not who we say we are to other people. Like, or our brand is not that. If we had a stayed silent, and we stayed silent for a long, 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 long time. You know, that's an eternity when you know you have this project that you're working on. And just to put it out there in the world, like, you know, it went, you know, all we did was launch a beer, right? A collaboration beer. Like, on the headline of it is, you know, that's what it really was. But it went all around the world, right? It went to States, it went to Australia. Like, people kind of understood that what we were doing was much more of a statement of solidarity. And I think that's really how we treated it. And we almost, like, had built a brand that was willing to, but also capable of carrying that collaboration, that humanitarian spirit of collaboration. And I think that's what, like, if I'm reflecting, most proud of, right? That we were also trusted by those guys to do that program, that collaboration with them and on their behalf at a really, really delicate time, which exposes them to more, you know, scrutiny, if you like, in a very, very difficult situation. But if we can build a platform that allows other cool people or people who are doing the right thing, because they're in the Middle East and their whole thing since 1994 was like they wanted to make the world a better place for beer, right? I mean, you could literally not make it up that there was this other brewer, albeit not wrapped in the same business model, but ultimately existed for the exact same reason. And if we could get a platform for them or anybody, where there could be this little fraction of solidarity being shared over a beer or through a beer, then I think like that's what, you know, that is a success, to get to your other question, to be able to build that platform for other people.
So, I mean, I guess the logical question there for me is, how do you know? It seems like you guys made that decision specifically based on kind of your personal values. Who do we want to be? Are we going to run? Is this the kind of company we want to run? Or, you know, who are we going to be? But now when you look back and, you know, I get the sense that you also kind of have a little bit more confidence that it was the right maybe business decision also, in terms of being able to increase your reach and the value of, you know, the media coverage and all the ways. How do you know that that is true, or do you know that that was true in terms of like balancing – When we go with our gut, we see success, and here's how we know we were successful. So I guess it's a shitty way of asking, how do you know it was successful? What can you look at from a data standpoint or a sales standpoint or just a, you know, the messaging, the feedback you're getting from your audience? How do you know it's successful?
I guess we, so far, we know it's successful in as much as, you know, that campaign, that initiative raised, you know, a significant sum, you know, in the immediate term for Taiba and the chosen charities, you know, which was the primary purpose for doing it, right? Beyond Alan and I's personal values and saying that was the right thing to do, you know, we saw a direct immediate outcome there that was positive for those people ultimately. I think going back to Alan's point around, you know, we would die on this decision, you know, It was almost that getting off the fence moment, I think, for us. You know, we've done a lot of positive things. We've given a lot of money away to various charities, both on a global and a local level. But I think this one was quite defining in terms of that particular issue. And a lot of people, a lot of businesses have stayed very quiet, you know, despite the fact maybe they are built in a similar way to us or have, you know, particular values. I was quite alarmed by just how much silence there was out there. And I think, you know, going back to Alan saying in 5 years' time, looking at ourselves and saying, you know, would we be proud of the fact if we were also stayed silent or not? I think it was that decision to get off the fence and commit And truthfully, like, we did not know what the repercussions of that were going to be on a particularly on a commercial level. Like, we as much as we think we connect with consumers that align to us, there's a lot of people that just buy our beer because it's on deal or they like the look of it, that potentially don't align with that, whether you see it morally or politically or otherwise. And there could have potentially been negative implications of that. You know, we might still see that play out in years to come if that story and campaign continues to, you know, bubble out there. But I think in getting off the fence, whilst yes, you might lose or alienate a portion of our customer base that, you know, we weren't necessarily aware of, but were participating or buying our products, I do see it as an opportunity to really announce what we're trying to do here at Brugadar and what it fundamentally stands for, and to really connect with that audience that might not necessarily know, you know, on a purpose or a mission front, what we stand for. And with that, I think comes, you know, the need for us to do more than just campaigns like that, right? We need a marketing strategy that can connect and bring those people further into the ecosystem and tell their story. But I don't think there's any denying that as a consequence of what we did with Sun and Stone, we were able to really connect even with bars in our local city and town that hadn't really heard of us before or really aware of what we did. But we always knew probably on a personal level we should be working with them. I think Sun and Stone was one of the first campaigns that really opened their eyes to what we were about and almost invited us in the door, which was really positive.
Yeah, I mean, like, the online sales were the highest they ever were, right? I mean, it was the equivalent of a Christmas over lockdown where that's just like a totally skewed, you know, like, picture, because that was the main method for lots of people of buying craft beer. You know, there was millions of eyeballs on the campaign for sure. And then there was inbounds from 16 different countries, right, saying, how can we get, like, we don't have enough beer in our supply chain, I guess, to even meet that demand, right? Like, we were kind of caught off guard, and we were prepared for the absolute worst. We were prepared for people to say, sorry, guys, you made such a political statement here, even though it wasn't. I mean, check it out. Like, it was all about humanity, solidarity. There was no sort of, like, overt, you know, it was doing it the way we wanted to do it. But we were prepared to have our beers delisted from certain retailers, right? We were prepared and faced that skew not being listed with other customers who would list our other stuff, right? Like, I mean, it, you know, the tolerance for failure or, you know, existential threat that thing did was significant. But it would also be like, well, if we can't make an impact through that type of campaign, not that this was designed in order to make that impact, but then there was absolutely no chance that the Brugadar concept could work in the beer industry. You know, we almost had to put the sort of, like, edge case way, way out there.
Yeah.
And if we can learn from that, then we can adapt to, like James says, and actually make that a part of it. But I just kind of want to stress, like, we're just in making a lot of it up, right? We're doing our best. Like, we're learning. We're not, like, super, you know, Harvard Business School graduates who saw an opportunity. We're just two guys and a team of seven other people who just passionately believe that the world could be a better place for beer. And I'm sorry if there's going to be loads of people listening to this being like, well, what's the data point, right? I'm sorry, we don't yet have one. We haven't taken our head out of the weeds to actually find out what the magic number or numbers are. So apologies for anyone who spent an hour listening to this and we haven't given...
Well, what I would say is, you know, the authenticity and the commitment that you guys have is, you can't teach the upside of that, right? I think there is an upside, and I think you guys are seeing that in your business as well. But it's very clear, it comes to you guys very authentically, and, you know, thinking about the impact that you're having is core to everything that you guys are doing. So you know, I would say, yeah, there's data points that maybe a Harvard, you know, economist might be able to tell us about the buying trends of Gen Z, whatever, that would be helpful. But the reality is, I think you guys are making a lot of decisions based on having a good feel for the type of people you want to speak to, and narrowing your audience to saying, hey, there's a progressive audience in there somewhere who identify as such, or who maybe don't even identify as such, but make their buying decisions as such, and we can be a product for them. And there's enough of them to sell a bunch of product along the way. It's pretty clear you guys are able to are finding your path in that. You know, one of the things I love about the episode, I spoke with Jay from Ben and Jerry's last week, is he was talking about their halo effect, which is basically like looking at the data points of saying, when we talk about Palestine, what's the impact on that post? Did we get people to sign the petitions? Did we get people more eyeballs to understand the issue? But then also looking at like, and then when we posted about ice cream in the follow-on post, did that post actually get more or less reach and algorithmic juice? And did we get more eyeballs on that thing too? And what I think they're finding is that they actually both work really well together. Like, it's not a mutually exclusive thing where you have to say, today we're going to focus on selling beer and tomorrow we'll focus on changing the planet, right? Like, it's like the things are going to play together, and it sounds like you guys have found a balance to do it.
Yeah, and it's difficult, right? Because how do you go from a big topic to like, oh, by the way, drink our nice beer, right? Like, it's a live experiment that, yeah, we'll get better at refining. But it is very much, you know, like you say, going off a bit of gut feel of like what just feels right, like what feels right. And we might make a misstep in the future. We might do something that feels that is wrong. But it's how do you codify what James and I have been doing for 10 years so that if James and I, you know, got hit by a bus or whatever it looks like, you can actually hand that brand over and it's fully formed. And I think that's probably the challenge that we're going to have to face in the next few while to say, actually, we need better people to run this business and this brand. How do they take the sort of feel, the gut feel, and distill it into something that's a, you know, you can actually run an idea through, you can run a campaign through and say, actually, that feels like Brewer, or whether or not James and Alan are in the room.
Yeah. And I think some of that work's been done, right? As much as Alan and I, you know, do remain part of those conversations around, like, what areas are we entering, or, you know, what noise do we want to try and make on this particular issue or space? You know, we have a trusty board, you know, as part of our foundation of people that are far more knowledgeable about certain forms of impact, you know, both on a global and a local basis. And it is, as Alan said, about how do we almost decentralize aspects of the Brewgetter business and the theory that mean that it's less dependent ultimately on us as individuals, you know, in a similar way as we've seen to other brands within the space. As much as I guess I'm going to keep referring to Ben and Jerry's, not purely for the James and Alan dynamic, but, you know, those guys have ultimately stepped away, and that business, you know, notwithstanding the challenges obviously they face currently in terms of a previous owner, you know, they have processes in place as to how they bring certain aspects to life without necessarily phoning up Ben and Jerry themselves to say, is this right or not? Unless that's going on and none of us know about it.
I'm interested. I'm going to try to hit you guys with some quicker fire questions because I know we're running over time here and I want to be respectful of your time. So what we already talked about, obviously, the token values-led brands. I'm curious, is there a brand or an organization that maybe we would be less familiar with that you guys are just look up to, that you're psyched about trying to emulate, that you're excited about the work that they're doing, that's, you know, maybe lesser known than a Ben & Jerry's or a Tony's or a Patagonia?
Sure. You go first.
Yeah, I guess, like, I take a lot of inspiration from, like, cool charities that are doing, like, or, like, non-profits, right? There's one called Common Goal, which I love, and it's like a football orientated piece where it's all about like giving opportunity through football, which I think is like the archetype soccer, right? Like, which is like the archetypal, you know, you can literally be in the slums of Rio de Janeiro and become a superstar, right? But that's not the path that everyone can take, right? Because it takes talent, luck, all that sort of stuff. But Common Goal, I think, like, try to connect those sort of superstar players with like grassroots, and then I think that's when, if you can tap into the grassroots of anything, any industry, any, you know, sport, any community, that's where the real change starts to happen. And I think that people who take like a different approach to, you know, existing who view a problem with an innovative, cool and engaging approach, that they're the people who will succeed in years to come. And I think Congo, from a soccer point of view, are one that I definitely like the look of, for sure.
Jim?
I think from a perspective of what we're trying to build, I think the guys at Lush do a really good job. I think they have found that balance of ensuring that a premium product is front and center. You know, the experience of unboxing, you know, through to obviously the end outcome of whatever you buy from them is top tier. But underneath that, and I guess, you know, that foundational layer of wanting to use that company and that platform for positive change, and really not shying away either in terms of, you know, how they do that, how they amplify it, and the areas they step into. I think certainly in the last few years in the UK, is a brand I've definitely admired.
So when you guys are feeling a little exhausted, or you're 6 months into trying to figure out supply chain logistics to Guinea, what do you do to refill your tank?
I actually try to get more exhausted. Working out, like, that is my therapy. Like, if I can go in for an hour and a half into, like, an intense run, like a hill run, trail run, like a CrossFit HYROX style workout, like, I come out of that with whatever problem I went into it, like, a lot easier to deal with, certainly, and then maybe some solutions to it. So I always think that when I get stressed, and I make it a part of every day to have at least 1 hour of, like, usually hopefully over lunchtime, like, just really intense exercise to kind of just flush out all the demons and, you know, get the endorphins going. And I think, you know, 9 times out of 10, the decisions you make after that are better than the decisions you would have made before that. So that's probably getting more tired to get rid of the different type of exhaustion, if that makes sense.
James?
I probably also choose to exhaust myself, but not through exercise, and actually more just by being a dad to a 2.5-year-old, which, yeah, I think in the earliest days of balancing a company such as Brugger with, you know, a baby under one, it's quite challenging, and you don't see the sort of upsides of that from it for energy point of view. But I think the older she gets, the more I'm sort of taking from that, in terms of inspiring and I guess motivating me to keep going. So
yeah, what strikes me is talking to you guys, and I'm constantly reminded of that when, you know, as outsiders, right, and we kind of see these cool companies and they're doing the cool thing, and you hit the like 60-second, yeah, these guys brew beer and change the world, and so their days must just be amazing. It must just be all like, you know, let's decide whether we want to build wells or brew beer in Palestine today. This is like the title of the meeting invite. But like in reality, there's blocking and tackling, right? There's PowerPoints and there's meetings and there's vendors and there's payroll and there's all the nuanced bullshit that goes into every job and every business. And it probably requires you guys to have an opportunity to fill your tanks back up just as well as the rest of us who maybe are doing work that's slightly less sexy, but still kind of the same.
Yeah, listen, man, there's days where it's an absolute nightmare, right? Don't get me wrong. But there are also days or moments within days that you're like, you know what, I'd rather be doing this than something else. And yeah, as long as we, like you say, refill the tank enough to get through between those little moments in a week or a month or a quarter, then it's worth it. And listen, I'm going to say this again because I keep saying it, it's an experiment. We don't know if it's going to work. We hope it will. We need some good luck. We need some smart decisions. But so far, so good. And if we've got this far, hopefully there's another at least 10 years in the brand as well.
So when you guys are, whether it's to your team or other folks, is there a book or a podcast that you guys recommend, you find yourself recommending most?
Wow. A book. Yeah, probably two books. I like when people go surfing. Can you hear that? Yeah, you can hear that.
Let My People Go Surfing, I believe.
Let My People Go Surfing, yes. Yeah. And then I think there's a book which I read as a young guy and I think always kind of sticks with me, is Ego is the Enemy. I think it's Ryan Holiday. Really, really short book, like, but it got me into a way of thinking. And then in terms of podcasts, I mean, how long have you got? Like, my God, I think that's the only thing I consume. It's probably,
well, what's the one that your friends think you're most annoying because you keep bringing up episodes about? Like, today, did you guys hear that episode of whatever?
Yeah, I think I'm very into, like, the fitnessy ones, because it's like adjacent to, like, it's not adjacent, it's like away from. So there's a one called Found My Fitness by Dr. Rhonda Patrick, and these are like 4-hour deep dives into the science of like creating, right? And I'm just soaking it all up, being like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, have you listened to this? And then someone's going to say, I don't have 3 or 4 hours. How do you have 3 or 4 hours to go and listen to that? You know, get a life. So that would probably be it.
How about you, James?
Podcast wise, I think Sam Harris has probably been a mainstay over the years. I think with Ella, my daughter, in play, books have just completely gone out the window. I'm reading this week Elmer the Elephant, which is just actually, it's World Book Day today, so she's gone in dressed as Elmer.
They sent a photo of that.
But yeah, it's given me a nice excuse, because I can't say I'm the best reader. Or the most obsessive reader of all time, but getting back into childhood favorites has been enjoyable over the past couple of years.
No, I mean, I will say that I very much understand where you're at, and you're going to realize something nobody ever tells you about being a dad is, like, there's some books that are actually kind of fun to read and a lot that's really suck to read, and your kid's going to like the ones that suck, right? They're gonna be like, we got to have this terrible one again. You're like, nah, can't we read like Where the Wild Things Are again or something?
Yeah,
you know, like something
totally.
That's like you connect with. Nah, that's not what they're going to want. They're going to want Peppa Pig all day long, man.
Yeah, for sure.
So last question, and definitely the most important for you guys. I'll ask you individually. If I was coming to Glasgow or Belfast, where would I get the best sandwich, and which of your beers would you pair with it?
Oh, you go first, Jim. I went first the last time.
So sandwich in the south side of Glasgow, there's a nice spot called Bocca. Do quite hearty focaccia-based monstrosities, I think is the word you would describe. It's difficult to get your mouth around it, but entirely worth it. Not necessarily for lunch, unless you want that slump, because that slump is just impossible to avoid with sandwiches of that size. In terms of pairing with a beer, you'd probably have to pair it with good beer, which is our flagship. 3.3% to offer some lightness to
nice
to that
beer, you know, the
kilo of sandwich you've taken on. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, so I wouldn't recommend a sandwich as such. There's a thing called a Belfast bat, right? And it's basically a loaf of bread that they cut almost into like half and then half again, and just fill with ham and cheese, like literally the bog standardist with lots of butter. And it's just a real Belfast thing. And I would actually probably have it with our lager, because it's just such a good execution. And it's just a simple flavor profile. And if you have that hearty big sandwich and then a nice lager to wash it down, then I don't think you're having a bad day.
I got to stop doing these interviews around lunchtime. This is a terrible decision.
Dinner time for us. So,
if people want to find out more about Brewgooder or you guys, where, you know, I know we can't try your products here in the States yet, but where's the best place for people to follow along on the journey you guys are on?
Yeah, so brewgooder.com, if you want to find out. We're on Instagram, you know, Facebook, things like that, just at Brewgooder, BREWGOODER. And then if you ever want to reach out, want to collaborate, want to get advice, want to give advice, Alan or James at brewgooder.com, you'll find us and you'll find our inbox. And yeah, hopefully we can connect and get you in particular, Neil, some beers for spending an hour with us.
I'm happy to come to on a sandwich tour just to make sure that's really the ulterior motive for this whole operation. Well, awesome, guys. I'm psyched to see where you guys head. It's clear to me that the intent is there and the sophistication is growing, and I think the market's here for it. Honestly, I think there's a lot of people who want to make conscious decisions about where they're spending their money and how they identify with the brands that they you know, advocate for, and I think you guys are on the path. So we'll throw all the links in the show notes. James and Alan, thank you so much for taking the time today, man.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.